Well, good afternoon, everyone. Good to see you here on this, again, a very warm Sabbath day, but a beautiful one nevertheless. By way of introduction, the Hampton Court Palace, which is located just outside the city of London, it has a grapevine. A grapevine that was listed in the 2005 Guinness World Records as being the largest grapevine in the world. Referred to as the grapevine, it is of the grape varietal called Shiva Grossa, which is commonly referred to as the Black Hamburg grape. It was planted in 1769, and so it's now over 240 years old. Arthur Archibald F. Barron, in his book Vines and Vine Culture, mentioned several large famous vines, none of which now survive except the one at Hampton Court. Next slide. Okay. Sandy's really nice. She's actually driving the computer for me. There's not a lot of room up here. He says that in 1887, though, it was 4 feet. At that time, 4 feet around the base. But now, in the more recent pictures you can see here, it's over 12 feet. 12 feet around the base. And the longest rod, or arm, if you will, that comes off the vine is approximately 120 feet in length. The vine is grown on the extension method where one plant fills a glass house. And although that's considered unusual today, in Victorian times it was thought that a larger crop was produced this way. Now the average crop of these black desert grapes is around 600 pounds. However, in the autumn of 2001, it was 845 pounds, which is the greatest crop they ever had. Now the vine grows here at the site of the first greenhouse that was built at Hampton Court. Now, when looking at this picture, it's certainly not a stretch to say that is no ordinary vine. No ordinary vine. But the concept of grapevines and vines in general, is very much at the heart of what we read in Scripture. And we find in the 15th chapter of John that it begins with this particular concept, where Jesus is bringing his disciples into a much deeper understanding and knowledge of something of great importance. And as he does this, he uses something, an example from the very world he created. He uses an example of a vine. Now here he speaks of himself as the true vine, a true vine, and its relationship with its branches, which is a physical illustration that is symbolic of something spiritual. He speaks of God the Father here too. He speaks of God the Father as the vine dresser, the one who prunes, the one who cares for the vineyard, the one that removes the things that shouldn't be there, the things that do not produce fruit. And here he speaks also of you and me. He speaks of us as branches, and how the proof of this spiritual relationship is in becoming like the true vine, becoming like that, all to the honor of the vine dresser. And it speaks to how the evidence is measured in what is referred to as bearing fruit, symbolic of something very important. So Scripture speaks about vines, speaks about a vine dresser, it speaks about branches and about bearing fruit. And in today's sermon, we will touch on all of these with the thought in mind that there is only one. There is only one true vine. There's only one vine dresser. There's only one that prunes us, cares for us, and develops us as we should be. And there's only one place. There's only one place for us to abide, one place to live. And in doing so, there is an attachment. There's an attachment that must be made. An attachment that must be made to the vine, of the branch to the vine, in order that we can actually bear fruit. An attachment that, if made, is so strong, if it's made the way it's designed to be made, it is so strong that no external force will ultimately compromise it or the fruit that it's intended to bring. Let's begin by turning to John chapter 15. John chapter 15 is part of the annual Passover service. It's common to include among the scriptures read that evening the words that we'll read here today in John chapter 15, words that Jesus Christ spoke to his disciples. And we're going to take a closer look at verses 1 through 6. 1 through 6 today. And as we do that, we'll refer to other scriptures, but it'd be good to keep our place in John 15 because we'll keep coming back to it. Now the scriptures today will be shown up on the screen. We will show them here as part of the slides if you prefer to view them there and don't want to turn to them. But we will have them here too again as well. But John chapter 15, John chapter 15, it begins. It begins at what is a likely time that occurred soon after the Passover meal, when Jesus and disciples were thereafter going to the Mount of Olives. There'd be 11 of those disciples, of course, because Judas Iscariot, who would betray Jesus, had already departed by that time. And perhaps it was suggested by the vines that they saw along the way, or by the wine which they had just shared, that Jesus makes this ever-powerful statement. He says, "I am the true vine. I am the true vine." He begins with yet another "I am" statement. We find a lot of these in the book of John, where Jesus declares, "I am the bread of life. I am the light, the world. I am the gate. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way and the truth and the life." And here he declares, "I am the true vine." The statement alone is profound. Jesus is not just any vine. He's not just any vine. He's the true vine. There is no other. There's no other like him. Which also suggests that there are other vines out there. Other vines we might think of as false vines. And if we were to go back in Israel's history, we would read in places like Isaiah chapter 5 that the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. And when Israel obeyed, when they were in tune with that, when they honored God as he asked them to, that worked out very well for them. They were very blessed. But of course we know from history, from what history teaches us, that Israel didn't always do that. They didn't always do that, and they ended up attaching themselves to something different. Let's turn to Hosea chapter 9. Hosea chapter 9, we'll be reading verse 10 here in a moment. But here we find this beautiful imagery, this beautiful imagery of a relationship that was so good at one point. It was great, and then it went sour, And the analogy starts with God looking at Israel as symbolic of grapes in the desert. Something not often found. It's actually rare to find them in the desert in such a place. And something very special if you do find them. Hosea 9 verse 10 reads, "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first fruits on the fig tree in its first season. But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves to that shame, they became an abomination like the thing they loved." So Israel detached. They detached from God. They detached from the true vine. And they attached themselves to a different one. Let's turn now to Hosea chapter 10 and read verse 1. Hosea 10, 1. It says, "Israel empties his vine, and he brings forth fruit for himself. According to the multitude of his fruit, he has increased the altars. According to the bounty of his land, they have embellished his sacred pillars." So the people of Israel, in this example, had rejected the true worship of God and replaced it with something different, something self-serving. Idolatry was very much at play here. At this time, Israel is known and shown to be very prosperous. But Israel became idolatrous in proportion to their prosperity. They were prosperous, very idolatrous. You might think of it as lots of money, lots of idolatry. They were rich. In short, though, they turned. They turned to a false vine, a false worship. They detached from the true God. Another notable example relating to a false vine is found in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Let's go ahead and turn there. I'll pick it up in verse 32. But much of the chapter here is devoted to the wonderful blessings of God. The blessings of God, and then to the unfortunate actions of Israel. Actions that prompted God to wrath and God to judgment. Another example of cause and effect that we find so much throughout the Bible. And here we find a reference to the vine of Sodom. The vine of Sodom. Deuteronomy 32, beginning in verse 32. It says, "For their vine is the vine of Sodom and the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras." So this is a rather comprehensive indictment of Israel. They're in very, very serious trouble. I mean, some of the worst kind of trouble. Things are so bad here that they're actually compared to the inhabitants of Sodom.
who, if we were to spend some time in Genesis chapter 19, we'd see that they were destroyed. They were destroyed by God because of their sin. Because of it. That is the vine that they chose. That's the vine they chose over God. This is what they attached themselves to. Their fruits are compared to gall, which is another word for poison. It's nothing but misery to themselves and others. Their clusters are described as bitter. As bitter. Grapes are typically found in clusters. So what's being described here is that individually and collectively, together, their moral conduct was depraved. As a group, individually and collectively. Their wine, their system of doctrines, their system of teachings, what it is they stood for, was described here, or is described, as poison. It's fatal and destructive. Again, this was the condition of what they attached themselves to. There's an interesting observation in Clark's Bible commentary, which noted, and I'm paraphrasing somewhat here, that it's very likely that the grapes produced near Lake Asphaltitis, which is the Greek equivalent to the Dead Sea, where Sodom and Gomorrah formerly stood, which is somewhere on the southern end, somewhere in that southern end of the lake, or the sea, so I say, that these grapes were not only bitter and a disagreeable taste, but they actually had toxic qualities. They actually were toxic. So overall, the Israelites were in a very toxic situation. And even what was produced from the land, in some regards, was toxic as well. You know, Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 21 reads, he says, "Yet I planted you. I planted you a noble vine, a seed of the highest quality. How then have you turned from me into the degenerate plant of an alien vine?" So the choice of what vine to attach to has been before God's people from the very beginning. Those He has called, those He has chosen to work with, it has always been there. And there is a true vine, there is a noble vine, and then there is an alien vine in its various forms. Even the word alien means foreign. It means strange. It's also a word that means adulterous. But God planted the noble vine. He planted the noble vine, the true vine, the only way to life and the only way to have it. And from the beginning, God has given this. He's given pure instruction, how to live, what to do, what not to do. He's given the highest of privileges, the highest. All reason enough that God should expect something from His people, expect them to live consistent with the advantages that He gives. But instead, they chose something different. They chose to attach themselves to an alien vine. So the plant became degenerate, and the fruit as well, because the branches took on the likeness of the vine they attached to. They took on that likeness. They became just like the vine they attached to. As we read earlier in John 15, verse 1, Jesus states, "I am the true. I am the true vine. He is the noble vine, the perfect vine." You know, when we think about horticulture, think about that in general, it's basically intensive plant cultivation for human use. And one of the most basic and essential principles in horticulture, one of the most basic things, is to plant the right kind, to plant the right quality of vine or tree, in order to assure the proper kind and quality of fruit. And why is that? Well, because no fruit can be better than the vine or the tree that it's attached to. It can be no better. There may be many branches, but if they are to bear the right kind of fruit, they must be part of a vine that supports that function, that supports that. Spiritually, only one true vine. There's only one that can do that. Only one has that capacity. Let's return now to John chapter 15 with the latter part of verse 1 and then verse 2. Again, we read earlier, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser." My Father is the vine dresser. "Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, He takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, He prunes, that it may bear more fruit." So God the Father is the vine dresser. Some renditions, such as the King James Version, refers to it as husbandman. There are other renditions that refer to it as gardener. But the Greek word for vine dresser, it's a Greek word called gerargos, which means the land worker. means the farmer, who typically would also be the landowner. And it refers to here in what we just read as the expert. The expert in growing grapes. The expert in pruning as well. You know, success in raising any crop depends largely on the skill of the farmer or the gardener. But God's people are branches. They are attached to the true vine, and the relationship here is God the Father as the owner who works the vineyard. He works the vineyard. He tends it, waters it, protects it, cultivates it, so it'll produce its maximum yield. And in the process of this, he prunes. He prunes the branches. There's no better spiritual farmer than God the Father. And the branches in God's vineyard are not left alone. They're not left alone or unattended. For in God's vineyard, he does not leave us alone. He tends to us. We're not left to do what we want to do. They are pruned. They are pruned as part of that process. You know, verse 2 mentions a couple of things that God the Father uses to promote the growth of fruit. He removes dead wood, and he trims live wood. He does both of those things. You know, pruning is necessary for any vine. It's necessary. Dead wood may even be worse than fruitlessness. Dead wood can harbor disease, can harbor decay. And an untrimmed vine will develop long, rambling branches that produce little fruit. Because in those cases, much of the strength of the vine would then be used to growing the wood instead of growing the fruit. Or put another way, the best results are when branches remain closer to the vine. When they remain closer and closer to the trunk or to the root system. But part of this process, God removes the dead wood. He just disciplines the life of his children so that it's directed in a way that promotes something. Promotes the right kind of growth. Not just any growth. The right kind. The right kind of growth. The right kind of fruit. And that's what he does. That's what the vine dresser does. When we think about the pruning of actual grapevines, it's typical that before the arrival of springtime, the keeper of the vineyard will prune off every superficial branch, every branch that is sickly or feeble. That is done so that the sap, which carries the nutrients, which carries the parts for the life and the growth of the plant, it can then flow. It can then flow to the healthy branches that will bear fruit. You know, viticulture is a term that describes the science, the production, and the study of grapes. And part of growing grapes in vineyards today is this concept of training the vines, and by extension, the branches. And the method that they employ is very, very important. This is not simply a job of keeping the vines from dangling on the ground. It's much more than that. Various training techniques are used to assist in controlling vigorous vines that produce too much foliage or too much leaves and not enough fruit. Some vines do that, or some branches do that. The techniques serve to increase exposure of the foliage to light, improve air movement through the leaf canopy, and reduce the risk of rot. It's all part of why it's trained, so it can be done in a maximum way. And many of these concerns are part of canopy management, which includes managing all the parts of the vine that are above ground. Canopy management is how the architecture of the leaf canopy is trained, and it's changed in order to beneficially alter even the microclimate around the vines and around the other branches. So branches, where they're placed, what they do, actually have an impact on other ones within a vineyard. And while the greater purpose of establishing a vine training system is this canopy management, in particular dealing with shading and how that's dealt with the fruit and everything else, there are other reasons to control that as well and what come into play. As members of the vitis family, grapevines are climbing plants that do not have their own natural support, like trees. Grapevines have woody trunks, but the weight of the vine's leafy canopy and the grape clusters will often bring the vine's cordons, so kind of the arms. They'll bring them down towards the ground unless they receive some kind of support, which is why if you see a vineyard, you'll typically see them held up by some trellis system like we see in the picture here. But in viticulture, growers want to avoid any part of that cordon, which again are the arms. They want to avoid that from touching the ground because of the plant's natural inclination to send out suckers or basal shoots from the vine that would take root, from these cordons, that would take root in the area where the cordon is touching the ground.
What happens is that these offshoots will leach. They'll leach resources, they'll leach water, nutrients, from the main vine, which can diminish the quality of both vines' grape production. So in the introduction, we referred to the grape vine at Hampton Court. And part of what keeps that vine thriving is that it has an extensive root system. Other plants that compromise its growth are kept out of the area. They're kept out from away from its root system, and its cordons are not allowed to touch the ground and compromise the plant. And again, this is done so that for the entire health of that grapevine. It's for the health of the grapevine. Okay, so why did I share all that news? I mean, unless you're actually really, really interested in vines. Maybe somebody wants to grow a vineyard here. But the analogy here is really, really powerful. Powerful analogy. Because anything that tries to go or grow outside the true vine, anything that attempts to go off on its own, even though in appearance it's still attached to the true vine, because a cordon's still attached to the true vine, even if it sends out a sucker or a basal shoot. But even if you have the appearance of being attached, if it goes off on its own, it compromises the production of fruit. It will compromise it. And part of what the vine dresser does is to prune the branches so it's trained in a way that increases the production of fruit. It's also pruned to protect the branch from itself and even its own inclinations from doing something that would not be beneficial to itself or the vine that it's attached to. That's part of what that is. God is intimately involved with that process with us. Intimately. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5. Here we find the lyrics to a song, one that starts with joy, but by the end of the second verse becomes something entirely different. But it's about the owner. The owner of a vineyard who withheld nothing for the benefit of that vineyard. And it's about the expectation that the vine dresser has of his vineyard. Isaiah chapter 5, and we will read verses 1 through 7. This is, "Now let me sing to my well-beloved, a song of my well-beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a wine press in it. He also expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge please between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done in my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? And now, please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste, and it shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no more on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression; for righteousness, but behold, a cry for help." So what began is this beautiful tribute. This beautiful tribute by the planter of the vineyard. The planter who removed all the barriers to make it work, who planted it, who planted the perfect vine, who provided all the protection that it needed to thrive, to survive, to be safe, who cultivated it so it could grow, so it could produce a wonderful crop, and also the means to even enjoy those blessings. It began beautifully, but it ended very disappointingly. The owner of the vineyard withheld nothing. He withheld nothing, but the owner did expect something in return. He did expect something. The vineyard had the responsibility to live up to what had been given it. It had that responsibility. And because the vineyard didn't produce, the abandonment of such an unprofitable venture was to be expected. I mean, after all, who would waste further time, energy, money, resources on something that just refuses to do what it's supposed to do? And here it also shows the removal of the hedge, of its walls, which speaks of the removal of protection. They detach themselves, and now God leaves them alone.
They detach themselves, now he leaves them. And then God removed the rain, without which there can be any fruit at all. The vine dresser expected a return. He expected a return from his efforts in his vineyard. He expects his people to bear fruit. That's his expectation. I think it's important just to take a few minutes to further consider the concept of who it is that God does bring into his vineyard. Who it is, and metaphorically, kind of how that is done. Let's turn to Romans chapter 11. Romans chapter 11, and Glenn will have the slide up here in a moment. But a relationship with a true vine is introduced and extended to all whom God the Father calls. And in Romans chapter 11, it speaks of this concept of grafting, using the example of an olive tree. And here the Apostle Paul addresses how many of the Israelites had rejected God's invitation and his guidance, and how God in time rejected them. He also, though, speaks of how God extended the hope of salvation to other nations, to other peoples, to the Gentiles. But as we will see and as we will read, Israel's rejection is not total, and Israel's rejection is not final. We'll go ahead and pick it up in verse 16 of Romans chapter 11. It says, "For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree." Go ahead and follow up on a scripture here in a moment, but I wanted to explain something here. "But for Israel, some did. Some rejected. Some rejected God and were like branches cut off." They were like that. But God is symbolically the basis of the entire root system, and he allows for a grafting to take place. I want to just take a moment and talk about grafting before we continue. You know, grafting is a horticulture technique, something they do that where they take tissues from one plant and actually insert them into another. They actually insert them so that the two sets of vascular tissues can join together, so they can actually join together. But let's also consider what it is what he was grafting. He was grafting wild olives. Wild olives. You know, a wild olive tree is commonly described not so much as a tree, but as a shrub. It's a shrub with small leaves and with a stem, more or less prickly, and with a small hard droop with little or no oil. And just so we know, a droop, that's the outer part around the pit of the olive. That's what that is. So suffice it to say, a wild olive tree is not typically looked upon very favorably, particularly as a producing plant, particularly in that way. But that a wild olive branch, that we would take one of those, that they would take that and be grafted into a fruitful tree, that would be thought useless. That would be thought contrary to nature. But God was using the grafting process to make a very important point, a very important one. Instead of grafting a good branch onto a wild tree, which was not uncommon in those days because usually the root system of a wild olive tree was pretty good, pretty strong. Instead of that, God took a wild branch and grafted it onto a good tree. A wild branch onto a good tree. And Paul's illustration here portrays the incomprehensible kindness of God. That he would do that. He would do what no human farmer would even think to do. To graft wild branches. You know, God does not confine us to our past. He doesn't do that. He doesn't confine us to who we were attached to before when we come to be attached to the true vine. He doesn't hold us to that before we were grafted. He does not hold us to that limitation. And it is an incredible display of his love that he would even be willing to do that. An incredible display. Let's continue with verse 22 in Romans chapter 11. He says, "Therefore consider the goodness and severity of God on those who fell severity, but towards you, goodness. If you continue in his goodness, otherwise you also will be cut off. And they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again." To do so again. Verse 24, "For if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature, and to a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these who are natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree? When we think about how God the Father brings people, when He brings people into His vineyard, there's several things going on. You know, by nature, we are branches of a wild vine. By nature, Satan, as well as aspects of human nature, is a representation of that. Of being a wild vine. And we must somehow be transferred, somehow grafted from Satan's influence and our own ways to Jesus Christ, the true vine. The grafting must take place. So Paul helps us to understand the grafting process by pointing out there is a need to be cut away, from the old connections, and then be grafted to the true vine. If we were to spend some time looking at what a surgeon does, for example, in grafting human tissue, and what a horticulturist does with plant grafting, we would find several principles that are common in both fields. First, the graft, it has to be severed. It has to be severed from its original area. It has to be taken from there. It has to be severed. Next, the recipient site actually has to be wounded. It has to be wounded. Cut into so that the deeper tissues can be exposed and the appropriate layers of graft and host can then be permitted to make vital contact. Here, a sacrificial cutting of the vine takes place in order to do that. And the vine oozes and it bleeds sap when a plant's done this way. Then the graft must be held. It must be held in the exact position to prevent further movement while these graft cells grow. While they grow into the stalk, and the stalk cells grow into the substance of the graft. They have to be held in place in order to achieve that. And as connection takes place, the graft is nourished, and a union and a healing is taking place. It takes time to do that. That's what happens. Over time, as the tissues are fully joined, the graft grows and expands and takes its place as a functioning part of the host. Much is similar in a spiritual sense. We must consent. We must consent to be severed from all connections and influences with Satan and of the world. To no longer conform to it. We are to live in the world. We have to do that, but we're not to be of the world. Not to be of it. That has to be severed. Then we must allow ourselves, and I do mean allow. We have to let this happen. You must allow yourself to be joined in a close and personal relationship with Jesus Christ, to follow Him in all things. But to do that, there is a wounding. There is a wounding, a sacrifice that must be made. We read in Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 5 that Jesus Christ has been wounded. He has been wounded for our transgressions. And God the Father willingly allowed His Son to do that, to be wounded, to die, to become a living sacrifice. Why? So that an attachment can be made. A living attachment can be made for you and me. But from the earliest stages of being grafted to the true vine, there is a need to be carefully kept close to the vine and kept from being bruised or torn away. And sometimes human and plant grafts fail to take. There are many reasons for this, but a common one is that the graft tissue was somehow moved. It was somehow moved out of position. In the spiritual realm, the graft may fail because of worldly temptations or other factors that overtake someone who's called into this relationship. Somehow this vital connection, somehow it gets interrupted. In the sermonette, we heard about distractions. Those are things that a pull, if allowed to take too much of a place, can move a graft if we allow it. It can move it. But without immediate intervention, the graft then dies. Then it doesn't take. That's what happens. It's quite interesting that in the natural world, though, a graft retains its character qualities and doesn't retain that of the rootstock that it's attached to. For example, if we took a red apple graft and grafted it to the yellow apple rootstock, we'd still get red apples off that branch. We'd still get that. But in the spiritual experience, a life that is grafted into Christ will in time lose its natural characteristics. And they'll gradually take on the character of the rootstock, the character of the vine, and be like Christ. In the spiritual realm, there's no limitation to that. Not like there is in the physical. And when that happens, the vine dresser is honored. The vine dresser is glorified. But in order to do that, the connection to the of the graft must hold. It must hold in order to do that. God the Father calls and brings people. He brings them into His vineyard to graft them to His Son. And in that vineyard, He protects. He removes what does not belong, and He prunes for the spiritual health and for the development of His people so that they can bear fruit. So they can bear fruit. Let's return to John chapter 15. I'm going to go ahead and read verse 2 once again and include verse 3, where Jesus makes a comforting statement to the disciples in the context of they being in a good pruned status. Verse 2, "Each branch in me that does not bear fruit, He takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, He prunes, that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I had spoken to you." In verse 3, Jesus recalls the statement made to the disciples at the foot washing. Again, around the time of the Passover meal, just prior to this, part of the symbolism included the foot washing and taking of the bread and the wine. In the latter part of John chapter 13, in verse 10, it reads, "And you are clean, though not every one of you." And there he's singling out Judas. He's singling out Judas, who was deliberately planning to betray him. Now, Jesus did not equate clean with perfect, but he recognized that the remaining disciples were devoted to him as branches, united to the vine. They made that commitment. Judas was an example of a branch that was cut off. Let's now continue with verse 4 of John chapter 15. It says, "Abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me." So Jesus refers here to the term abide. Abide in me. And he indicates that our very lives are held in place by this connection. And he uses here the example of a branch. Now, if you think about it, if a branch is cut off or detached or severed from the vine, how long would it live? Well, not very long at all. Not very long at all. And the word abide in Greek is a word called meno. And it simply means to stay. It means to remain. It means to endure. It also means to stand in a given place. To stand in a given place. You know, earlier we talked about the importance of the grafting process, taking hold of the importance of staying in place. Abiding is about attaching and never letting go. That's what abiding is about. Attaching and never letting go. Never. And if we abide in this way, Jesus will abide in each of us. He will live in you and me. He'll make His home with us. And if that's not profound enough, so will God the Father. In John 14, verse 23, we read, "If anybody loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." So here, God the Father and Jesus Christ will attach to us and never let go. Never. Continue with John 15, verse 5. It says, "I am the true vine." Or, "I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing." You can do nothing. Some time ago, the Associated Press released a study done by an agricultural school in Iowa. It reported that production of 100 bushels of corn from 1 acre of land, in addition to the many hours of a farmer's labor, required 4 million pounds of water, 6,800 pounds of oxygen, 5,200 pounds of carbon, 160 pounds of nitrogen, 125 pounds of potassium, 75 pounds of yellow sulfur, and other elements too numerous to list. In addition to these things, which no man can produce, rain and sunshine at the right time are absolutely critical. You know, earlier it was mentioned that success in raising any crop depends largely on the skill of the farmer. And that is true. But in our physical world, as much as the farmer may work hard and be skilled, there's so many things that a farmer cannot do. They just cannot. things that only God can do that will ultimately bring a crop to yield. So many things. And the study concluded that only an estimated 5% of the produce of a farm can be attributed to the efforts of man. 5%. So how much can we do, spiritually speaking, without God? Well, as we just read, nothing. Can't even do 5%. Nothing at all. God the Father is the vine dresser. He's the ultimate farmer. He's the ultimate grower. The human farmer cannot compare to the eternal one. Even if we were wise enough, smart enough to distinguish what was needed to have a healthy vineyard, even if we knew that, if we had the smarts for that, none of us possess the power to control it. We don't have that power. We cannot of ourselves do anything that will bear the fruit that God desires. Not on our own. Nor can we, on our own power, protect ourselves from the elements, from conditions, influence that, frankly, are out to seek to destroy or to ruin our spiritual crop. We have that power. Earlier we read in Romans chapter 11, verse 16, that if the root is holy, so are the branches. The root's holy, so are the branches. God's root system will not fail. Nor will the true vine, nor will the branches, if they stay attached. If they are pruned as God needs them to be. But if someone does attach to something outside the true vine, outside of God's root system, outside of the vine system, they will be susceptible to many things. They'll be susceptible to harm. They'll be susceptible to compromise. In June 2009, viticulture and horticulture experts Patty Skinkis, Von Walton, and Clive Kaiser put together a publication for Oregon State University titled Grape Phylloxera, Biology and Management in the Pacific Northwest. Now, what is grape phylloxera and what does it have to do with what we're talking about today? Well, grape phylloxera is an aphid-like insect that feeds aggressively on grape roots. Some American grape species are resistant to phylloxera. Others are not. European wine grapes, however, are the most susceptible. If that were not bad enough, there's no way to eradicate phylloxera from an infested vineyard. It will eventually kill susceptible grapevines. Interestingly, the only way to manage an infestation in the long term is to replant the vineyard with vines grafted to a resistant rootstock. Isn't that fascinating? So what is it that these little creatures do? Well, they feed exclusively on grapevine roots. From this picture, we can see some ants along with the phylloxera over here. They're over there on these little roots, having a ball. But in susceptible Vitis vinifera species, the feeding causes galls. This is what these things do. They cause galls to form on the roots. And the insects live on the surface of these root galls. Now, these root injuries, they do many things. They impair the absorption of nutrients and water, and it causes a decline in the vine vigor and vine productivity. And what is seen in infested vines is that they drop their leaves earlier than healthy vines. Their foliage turns yellow more quickly. Their shoot growth also declines. The fruit production is reduced, sometimes radically. It may take 2 to 5 years from the time of the initial infestation for symptoms to appear. Again, this depends on vine vigor, the method of infestation, and the location of the planting. So any vineyard can be the source of phylloxera, even if no visible symptoms are present. And it can accelerate quickly. In warm areas, such as California, phylloxera have 4 to 5 generations per season. They grow fast and multiply fast. And vineyards may decline quickly in as few as 3 to 5 years. Most major grape-growing regions in the world have now been infested with phylloxera, including France, South Africa, California, Italy, and New Zealand. These places still manage to grow grapes profitably, even though, through the use of these resistant rootstocks. I keep calling rootstocks. However, the cost of replanting vineyards, including lost production, over the last 5 years are extremely high. And this is not a new phenomenon. This is not new. History has shown that it destroyed millions of hectares of vineyards in Europe in the 1800s, nearly wiping out the French wine industry at the time. These little creatures can survive under virtually any climatic conditions tolerated by its host plant. Infested vines live longer in fertile, deep, well-drained soil than in shallow soil or soil with poor drainage. The soil does matter, but if they come in, if they infest, they will do their work. They will do their work. So what is it about these that we can learn? About these little creatures and what they do that we can learn about spiritually? Well, if someone attaches to a false vine, if they're part of a false root system, it will end up in failure. It's inevitable. Metaphorically, its rootstock is not resistant to infestation. It's not. The bad fruit of attaching to a false vine may not show up immediately. It may not be seen, or maybe beyond the comprehension of someone who is attached. They may not see it. It could happen so slow, but it will happen. It will happen, no matter how strong we think we may be. And part of the point here is that we may not even see it. Again, because of how slow they work. How slow they work. Grafting to the true vine, having an attachment that is unmovable, that is unshakable, a relationship that abides in Christ is the only answer. Otherwise, a spiritual infestation will come. If we abide with Christ, He and God the Father will make a home with us. If we abide somewhere else, then something else will make its home with us. Something else will make its home. Let's return now to John chapter 15, and we'll pick it up in verse 6. John 15, verse 6, the last verse we'll refer today in this chapter. It says, "If anyone does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and is withered, and they gather them and throw them into the fire, and they are burned." And earlier it was mentioned that the leaf canopy of a vineyard requires training, and that part of that process is controlling vigorous vines that produce too much foliage and not enough fruit. With that in mind, I'd like us to turn now to Matthew chapter 21. We're going to look at an example where Jesus uses a fig tree to demonstrate judgment, an example that is in many respects reflective of the test of whether someone is really attached, whether they're really attached to the vine or not, whether someone is abiding in him or not, whether there really is fruit or not. In this example, Jesus approached a fig tree in the hope of alleviating his hunger. Let's go ahead and read Matthew 21, 18 through 19. It says, "Now, in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it but leaves, and said to it, 'Let no fruit grow on you ever again.' Immediately the fig tree withered." And if we were to read the parallel account of this in Mark chapter 11, it indicates that the tree was in leaf, but it also indicates that it was not the season for figs. It wasn't the season. Well, Expositor's Bible Commentary had some interesting comments I'd like to share. Fig leaves appear about the same time as the fruit, or a little after. The fig leaves are edible. The green figs. Well, the leaves might be edible too, but the green figs are edible, though sufficiently disagreeable as not to usually be eaten until June. They don't taste very good unripe, apparently. So the leaves normally point. The leaves normally point to every prospect of fruit, even if not fully ripe. It points to that. And the commentary concludes that its leaves advertise that it was bearing, but the advertisement was false. It was false. Jesus, unable to satisfy his hunger, saw the opportunity of teaching a memorable object lesson and cursed the tree, not because it was not bearing fruit per se, whether in season or not, but because it made a show of life. It made a show that promised fruit, but none was bearing. It made a show, but there was no fruit. Might think of this figuratively as, look at me. I'm a big leaf. Attitude which is very typical of the Pharisees. But there was no evidence of fruit. No evidence. No fruit behind it. It was false advertising. False advertising. As we read earlier in verse 5 of John 15, it shows that if we abide in Christ, then we will produce fruit from that relationship. And if we do not, then God will ultimately remove us. And false advertising, which is hypocrisy, it has no future. Either attached to the true vine or we're not attached to the true vine. And the fruit, the evidence of fruit, is the proof of that. It's the proof of that. If we were present with the disciples and heard Jesus refer to himself as the true vine, and that his people are the branches, we may have had some mixed emotions at the time. On one hand, we're probably quite familiar with the idea of comparing people to vines and vineyards. Grapevines were certainly a common or familiar sight in Palestine. We would know how God brought Israel out of Egypt and the analogy of God planting Israel to the promised land. We would have read or at least heard the words of the Hebrew prophets who likened Israel to a vine or to a vineyard. Perhaps we may have recalled the words of Isaiah when he referred to earlier in the sermon that we referred to. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. Perhaps we would have also thought of the parable where Jesus expressly made use of the vineyard as a symbol for Israel. For example, in Mark chapter 12, where he concluded the parable by saying that the owner of the vineyard will destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. Might have remembered that. May have remembered the response to the parable given by the religious leaders, leaders who wanted to arrest Jesus because they realized he told that parable against them. The symbolism of the vineyard was not lost on them. On one hand, we may have thought about the wonderful blessings of being called to be part of the vine and the vineyard, and the blessings of being able to know that. On the other hand, maybe we had a little sense, or could have had a little sense of introspection, as we thought about the fruit that was expected of us, fruit that perhaps we have not shown yet. Thoughts that may have brought maybe a little bit of a sense of apprehension, because we knew how important it was and what the expectation was. There were times when ancient Israel understood that they fell short, times that they understood that. And in reality, if we are honest with ourselves, we too have done things which were not mindful of the true vine, and not mindful of the vine dresser, not mindful of the sacrifice that's been made for us, the wound to graft us in, the sacrifice which allows us to be attached to the true vine, to be part of God's vineyard, to have a home with God the Father and with Jesus Christ, and share in the love that God has for us. I would like for us to read a portion of the 80th chapter of Psalms from the New Century Version, as it shows the people who petitioned God to return. They petitioned to return to them after they had forsaken him. They asked that he return and take care of them. I'll go ahead and read verses 7 through 19. And I'll do this again from the New Century Version. It says, God all-powerful, take us back. Show us your kindness so we can be saved. You brought us out of Egypt as if we were a vine. You forced out other nations and planted us in the land. You cleared the ground for us. Like a vine, we took root and filled the land. We covered the mountains with our shade. We had limbs like the mighty cedar tree. Our branches reached the Mediterranean Sea and our shoots went to the Euphrates River. So why did you pull down our walls? Now everyone who passes by steals from us. Like wild pigs, they walk over us. Like wild animals, they feed on us. God all-powerful, come back. Look down from heaven and see. Take care of us, your vine. You planted the shoot with your own hands and strengthened this child. Now it is cut down and burned with fire. You destroyed us by your angry looks. With your hand, strengthen the one you have chosen for yourself, then we will not turn away from you. Give us life again, and we will call to you for help. Lord God, all-powerful, take us back. Show us your kindness so we can be saved. Scripture speaks about vines, about a vine dresser, and about branches, and about bearing fruit. And from God's word, we can see that there's only one. There's only one true vine. Only one vine dresser that prunes us, takes care of us, develops us as we should be. There's only one place for us to abide, one place to live. And like the grafting process, or the process of grafting plants, there is an attachment. There is an attachment that must take place. It must. Of the branch to the vine, in order so that we can bear good fruit. An attachment that binds us to God. An attachment that we should never let go. An attachment that, if made, is so strong, no external force will ultimately compromise it, or the fruit that it's intended to bring. But if circumstances, brethren, are such that we have somehow compromised that attachment, then let us humbly on our knees ask God to take us back. To please take us back. May we all endeavor to stay, to remain, to endure, to stand in a given place, to abide with, and forever be attached to the true vine.